This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We taped Discover Lafayette at Raider's headquarters in the Oil Center of Lafayette. Raider is a managed IT service provider that offers world-class service, including cybersecurity, communications, and technology support. With Raider, you have just one vendor and one number to call, allowing you to concentrate on what is most important, your business. For more information, visit RaiderSolutions.com. And while we're talking about Raider, many thanks to Jason Sikora of Raider, who records and mixes our sound, ensuring a professional podcast production. The generosity of Ochsner Lafayette General makes this podcast possible. Ochsner Lafayette General understands that each patient is unique, and so is your path to good health, from the miracle of childbirth to the mending of broken bones or the journey through cancer. Ochsner's physician and care teams provide access to more than 90 specialties and an ever-expanding list of convenient locations right here in Acadiana. With Ochsner Lafayette General, you're cared for through every stage of life, and healing isn't just a destination. It's a journey we walk together. For more information, visit ochsner.org/Lafayette. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lafayette-based ViMed. In addition to its national prominence in post-acute respiratory care and sleep therapy, ViMed's sister company, ViMed Healthcare Staffing, otherwise known as VHS, can assist any clinician listeners out there searching for a new career opportunity. Visit ViMed.com to learn more about how their staffing services benefit both medical professionals and hospital systems. Our guest today is Dr. Amanda Logue, Chief Medical Officer for Ochsner Lafayette General. Dr. Logue completed her undergraduate training at LSU in microbiology and medical training at LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport. She completed her residency training and chief resident year at University of Tennessee in Memphis in internal medicine. Dr. Logue is board certified in both internal medicine and clinical informatics. We invited Dr. Logue to join us today and share information about Ochsner Lafayette General's new general surgery residency program. And we talked before, Dr. Logue, I may call you Amanda as we go forward. Thank you. Thank you for your public service, for keeping us healthy, and for joining us today on Discover Lafayette.
Thank you so much for having me. Yes. I am flattered to be here, and please call me Amanda.
Thank you.
I am happy to have to be part of the program.
Thank you. And I want to thank Jason Sikora for being here with us and making this podcast so professional. So we have a lot of questions about the new surgical residency program, but some people may not know much about your background, Amanda. And I understand you're from Baton Rouge, your parents are there. And if you can tell us about your career, you know, going into medicine and what led you to Lafayette.
Sure. I did grow up in Baton Rouge, spent most of my young years there. I ended up going to high school at McKinley. Everybody always wants to know where you went to high school in Louisiana. I went to LSU for undergraduate and then moved to Shreveport for medical school. After that, I went to University of Tennessee in Memphis for my training, my internal medicine training. When it was time to look for a job, we definitely looked to come back south again, and that was where our family is. I was with my husband then. We were married, and we had two kids by the time I finished residency. So we were looking to get closer to grandparents and get some help and also just return to Louisiana because we love it. And we decided to look outside of Baton Rouge a little bit, and somebody recommended that we look at Lafayette. When we came to Lafayette, it was obviously a great city. It had great vibes about it. It's got the university here. It's got amazing culture, very different from Baton Rouge.
Very different. 50 miles, right?
It's amazing how much that changes when you cross that bridge. But it was great, though. It had everything that we were looking for. And at the time, Lafayette General was only two hospitals. But I could tell in my interview time that the CEO at the time and the other physicians that I was meeting with, there was an intention to make it a great place to work, a great place to receive care. And I could tell that there was a vibe that something I wanted to be part of. So I came on as a hospitalist and worked.
Would you define that?
Oh, sure. Hospitalist, it is kind of a term that people are still getting used to. Essentially, I'm internal medicine trained. When patients come into the hospital and they don't have a primary care doctor and they need to be admitted, or if their primary care doctor works in the community and doesn't make rounds at the hospital, that's where our team comes into play. And so we'll take care of you. We'll take care of all of your hospital needs. We'll be the quarterback of the team. And then when it's time for you to be discharged, we'll get you back with your doctor and get them the information they need to continue on. So I was a hospitalist for a few years and started to do, I was the medical director of the hospitalist team, got some more exposure there. That's where I really started my journey into leadership, into physician leadership. After that, I started joining some of the committees for the hospital, learning more about infection prevention and ICU committee, a variety of quality things. And they approached me about being part of the IS team, the information systems team.
Wow. Did you train for that?
Not at all.
No.
I was just
Radio background or anything?
No background whatsoever. My husband's in IT, but I don't think that that really was a factor. So I joined to be a physician champion when they were ready to install the first electronic medical record. And after that, I joke that I passed the test, the EMR went live and everything stayed on and there wasn't a large revolt.
Wow.
And so then they asked me to be the chief medical information officer. So I did that for the next 5 years and did a little less clinical time, got more into that. And at that same time, Lafayette General was growing. They were bringing on the hospital, UHC hospital, and then some of the more rural areas that we have now. So it necessitated more time. And as I went through that, then the option for the chief medical officer position came open in 2019, and I was asked to take that lead.
Yeah. So you've been there about 15 years?
It'll be 15 years in October.
And you were hired under the David Callicott, I guess, tenure, and now you've got a great doctor, Patrick Ganjan.
Yep.
So, so you were still practicing medicine. Before we get into the meat of the program, we were talking before we started recording. And you said you were working yesterday, like Sunday, you were making rounds.
I did make rounds yesterday. I really find it's so important to continue to do that when you're a physician leader. Find some way to stay connected and to continue practicing. Initially, I did it because I wanted to maintain credibility with my peers. But when I practice, I get so much more out of that. The patients are amazing. The families are so grateful. We have such a good time. But I really get to connect with the nurses again. I get to connect with all of the techs and the housekeepers and everybody that does all the work to take care of patients. This is Nurses Week, too, so happy Nurses Week to them.
I didn't realize that.
So I got to see a bunch of them yesterday, and they're just doing a phenomenal job taking care of our patients. So it's really rewarding to be able to see how they work, how hard they work, and the amount of passion they put into taking care of our patients. In addition, I get to see my peers on a peer-to-peer level. We talk about patient care again, and we talk about, about what we're doing the next weekend with our families. So I get to reconnect with everybody that way. Plus, I get to keep my clinical skills, and I think that makes me better at my job. So I try to work that in as often as possible.
So you're a professional, you're a mother. So your children now must be, in their later teens? Or
I have three kids. They are 16, 14, and 10.
So you've learned how to juggle everything.
Everything.
Like family life, work life, and sharing duties.
I have to say that my husband is an amazing partner in that.
Be.
I could not do that without him. And I also have a great village of friends and family around. So it definitely takes a team effort. Anybody who's trying to take care of a family knows that. So we've been blessed.
Well, I'm so glad to have you here. I want to jump in, about this surgical residency program. And maybe it should have been a later question, but I understand there's a shortage of physicians, especially in rural areas. So we're here. Lafayette is medium-sized city at best, but we're surrounded by rural communities. And so let's talk about what, describe the new surgical residency program and kind of get into what is it,
Well, you're right, Jan. There is a physician shortage. There's a physician shortage now. We talk a lot about nursing shortage, and that's why Ochsner has jumped into the field of getting into creating new academic programs with our university partnerships so that we can create more nurses, because that's a huge problem. But the physician shortage is a little quieter from time to time. People don't talk about it quite as much, but it is certainly a huge problem. And it's only projected to get worse. By the year 2030, there's supposed to be, I think, close to 100,000 physician shortage in the nation.
Right.
Unfortunately, Louisiana ranks towards the bottom of the list in terms of where how big the shortage is going to be.
Is it in all fields?
It is in all fields, but it's certainly primary care tends to be one of the ones that is most affected.
Yeah.
Yes. And GPs, internal medicine, family medicine. You could also lump pediatrics and OBGYN because they serve as primary care for a lot of patients. So there's definitely a shortage across the board. The rural areas are especially vulnerable. When you talk about physician practices, they're just like anybody else. They want to practice with a team. They want colleagues around. They want people to lean on when there's a tough case, you know, when they have questions, especially if you're new out of training. So trying to get somebody into a rural area is that much harder because they are, you know, they don't have the built-in network around them of specialists to lean on. And that can be intimidating. Mm-hmm. So it really takes a special doctor. I mean, huge shout out to our rural doctors that we have right now. They are amazing and they can do so much. They have had to figure it out.
Jack of all trades.
Exactly. So, exactly. And it's great
to
see.
That's like it used to be.
It is like it used to be. It is like it used to be. And it's, but it's not where we are anymore. And so when people come out of training, they're really looking for a very comprehensive network around them, which is also terrific. But it's just not reality in a state where you have a lot of rural areas.
Right.
And so we have to be really creative with how we get doctors interested in practicing in those areas.
So what exactly is graduate medical education?
Yes, graduate medical education, or GME as I'll call it, is the umbrella under which the medical training happens after you finish medical school. Mm-hmm. So it encompasses all your residency programs and all your fellowship programs. Mm-hmm. And it is an accrediting body called the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, or ACGME is what I'll call it a lot of times.
It is a mouthful,
but they are responsible for overseeing the accreditation of all of your sponsoring institutions and any residency or fellowship training program that you want to start and continue to have in your in your area.
So Oxford couldn't have just started this up without becoming accredited. I mean, this is a big accomplishment.
It's a big accomplishment, and it is something that we've been talking about for 8 to 10 years
Seems
now.
Seems like I've been hearing about this.
We have been talking about it because everybody knew that we were ripe for having training here. I mean, it's a growing organization. There's a lot of patients coming through. Mm-hmm. Kind of all the right things were falling into place, but it takes a lot of work. There's a large application. You have to have a lot of infrastructure in place in order to apply for it, and it's a rigorous process. So until you kind of have all those pieces coming together, then you're not ready.
So I'm just thinking, listening to you, with the high number of trauma cases you probably get at Ochsner here in Lafayette, I mean, we can support trauma patients, but you've got diversity that probably a lot of hospitals don't have. Did that help in getting accredited?
Oh, definitely it helps. When you're thinking about starting a program, it doesn't matter what specialty you're considering. You want to make sure that you have a wide variety of patients because that is the intention of a good residency or fellowship program, is to be able to offer as much variety as they can see in their few years, their 3 to 5 years of training, because they need to be exposed to as much as possible. So when they're out on their own after they're finished, they've had exposure, they understand what they're seeing, they've learned. And so before we started considering a surgical residency program, we had to look at our volumes, and the trauma level came into play to help us with the amount of patients that we would get into the hospital.
Did y'all choose surgical? Is that one of the highest needs, or was that just the most obvious place to start?
Both, actually. It was both. It's definitely, general surgery is very much needed specialty, especially in the rural areas as well. And when we started looking at, you know, are we ready for this, we had a lot of lots of patients coming through the operating rooms, lots of unique cases. Being a level 2 trauma center certainly helped draw more business in. And also, we had a lot of interest. We had doctors who were really, really excited about becoming teachers. Mm-hmm. And that is, to me, as important as the volume of patients that you have, because you really need to have enthusiastic teachers for right. them to walk away with a good experience and be well prepared for their future.
And I'm going to let you name those doctors that are with Ochsner Lafayette General. I don't want to mispronounce someone's name, if you can tell us who's now part of that
certainly.
Team.
Oh, certainly. So first we had to become a sponsoring institution, and we did that in 2022. And then after that, we went into starting a general surgery residency program. It's another application process, mm-hmm. a whole set of paperwork that you got to do. But in that process, we had to name our designated institutional officer, our DIO, who is Dr. Ziad Ashkar.
Thank you for pronouncing that for me.
Sure. And then for the general surgery program, we have our program director, Dr. Dennis Eshde. He's been a general surgeon and a bariatric surgeon pillar mm-hmm. in the community for quite some time. So we were really excited to have him. He's heading up the whole thing and is super excited about it. And then we have a whole host, a couple dozen physicians that will be involved in the program. But some of our core group is Dr. Will Mosier, who's our head of trauma, Dr. Jason Bro, who is a surgical oncologist, Dr. Mike Ore is a mm-hmm. specialist in colorectal surgery, and Dr. Joe Ganami is our vascular surgeon. Yeah. So they're going to make up our core group, but we have a whole bunch of teams around them that will mm-hmm. help teach all these residents when they come through.
What an opportunity. So you're starting out with surgical residency, and I'm sure you're going to be looking to pursue other accreditations as you take off, if you want to just mention what those fields will be.
Yes, we are excited for this one to start in July. We have our first mm-hmm. few residents coming in July,
huh?
Three residents coming in. We had a bunch of applications for that.
600, I read.
Almost 600 applications for three spots. I wish we could offer more spots because obviously the demand is there. And I think we will grow into it. But mm-hmm. We had to start conservatively, make sure we didn't, you know, get out ahead of ourselves too
right.
early. But yes, Jan, we want to start with general surgery. And after that, we're looking to do an internal medicine program to help fulfill the primary care needs. We are interested in possibly emergency medicine and possibly a transitional year, which is sort of a year for residents to get a wide exposure before they mm-hmm. go on to another specialty.
You know, this is off the cuff, this question. Do many doctors change direction of their path? Like, you're an internist, mm-hmm. you know. What if you wanted to become a surgery specialist? I mean, does that happen?
It happens, but it's really
rare.
Hard, and it's
Is
very
it?
Rare. It's not like changing a major in college.
Yeah.
You have to go back to the beginning of residency. So if I've done 2 years of internal medicine training and then I decide I want to do surgery, I have to drop out of my residency program and
Reapply?
Get back into the match program and try to go into a general surgery program. So you have to start all over. So mm-hmm. it's pretty rare. But people do it. They change their minds. Or a lot of times people will finish their residency and then go on to a second residency or a fellowship because they mm-hmm. want to be more specialized at that point. So it doesn't happen very often.
Right.
But, you know, just like people changing their college majors, they can figure out that something's not for them.
Exactly.
You really try to figure out in medical school what you're good at
that's
and
what
you really like. So
and what
that's
you see. Yeah.
That's where you get the most of your rotations.
I'm always amazed at those five people that are both lawyers and doctors. Like, I wonder, what were they thinking, you know?
I don't know.
Survivors.
That's right.
So I'm curious about your longstanding partnership, Ochsner, with the LSU School of Medicine. How does this program affect that partnership, or does it?
We've had that question a few times because it, you know, certainly is like, well, we have a residency program in Lafayette. Why do we need another?
Mm-hmm.
So our program and our partnership with LSU has been in place for many years, and they run a terrific program mm-hmm. over there. They have two programs over there, internal medicine and family medicine. They had 100% fill match rate this year again. They do a great job with turning out internists and family mm-hmm. medicine doctors over there, and they've done a great job, and we work with them all the time on their programs, and we love to interact with their residents. They see all of our patients. Mm-hmm. We felt like there was more teaching that was available here than just mm-hmm. Than just those two programs. So when we really started looking at what could we support more in this area, it really comes down to volume of patients. Do you have enough patients mm-hmm. that still could be seen with residents learning from those cases. And so when we started looking at what the main campus hospital also saw coming through, we really recognized that we could add to it. And this is all for the exact reason that we started this program, which is to fill the vacancies that we will have in a physician shortage,
right,
you know, over the next decade. So we have to do this.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious how many patients these residents see in a year or two. I mean, I can't imagine the volume of people that show up.
I couldn't give you numbers like that. Mm-hmm. I do know that I just recently pulled some data and we had 140,000 visits come through just the UHC clinics in 2023.
Oh my gosh. You think that's average?
Oh yes, for sure. It's average. It's probably growing because those clinics grow and you know, we've added some additional help over there too. And so definitely a huge volume, huge need.
Yeah. And that's some of the top doctors in our region that are affiliated with UHC.
So they're terrific. Yeah. There's a combination of doctors that are employed by Lafayette General, and there's LSU faculty there as well, too. Mm-hmm. So they're a great mix over there. They do a fantastic job.
So for the surgery residency program, what significance does this hold for Ochsner? Like, what does this give your organization?
It definitely helps change the culture of Lafayette General. It adds a new academic culture to it, which is great for a learning experience. It's great for our patients. You know, our doctors, our medical students that are coming out and join our residency program are very, they're brand new. They have all kinds of new information that they bring to the table. They keep us fresh. They keep us on our game with the newest and the greatest treatments that are out there. So, and it also solidifies, you know, a partnership with Ochsner that has been talked about since before the merger. It has always been our interest to be able to bring a residency program to Lafayette General. But it wasn't until we went through the merger with Ochsner that we were really able to get the resources to do so.
Right.
They brought to the table the infrastructure because they have many training programs throughout the state already. They have all of the teams in place to support those residents and support the administrative side of it. And they offered that right up to us. Mm-hmm. We had to build upon it here, so we have our local presence. But it was huge in terms of getting us started and getting us the resources that we needed to really make the next stage happen. So it's been one of those great outcomes of this merger that has just brought something so different to the community and really excited to build upon it.
Right. What is the expectation for these surgical residents? Do you think they'll stay in Lafayette? What have you seen from your experience about when people train, where they end up?
There is some pretty good data out there that shows that residents tend to practice within about 70 miles of where they do their terminal training. So if they go on to a fellowship somewhere else, then, you know, that's their terminal training. But if they finish their program here in Acadiana, we got a good shot of keeping them in Acadiana. I certainly know they're going to fall in love with the place. That's the easy sell. Then it's about, where are they going to land to do their practice? The residents end up, and fellows end up making a lot of relationships with other community physicians while they're here. They share cases together. They get to see cases in the hospital together. So by the time they're finished with their training, and general surgery is a 5-year program, so they're going to be with us for 5 years. By the time they finish their training, they have made partners across the way. They have they've worked with all these local physicians in the community. They kind of have their network building around them.
Yeah.
So it's really exciting to go ahead and start practice at that point because you have a lot that's already set up for you.
Yeah, and they're planning routes.
They're planning routes for sure.
Too,
many times they will, meet a spouse here and start a family, and certainly that helps solidify that as well. If they go off for a training and doing a fellowship somewhere else, we certainly keep close tabs on them. We want to keep the relationship going and see if we can re-recruit them back here.
Yeah, track their phones.
Absolutely. You know? I don't know about that far, but something like that.
I'm kidding. No. Well, I'm reading your mission. It's to serve, heal, lead, most importantly, I think, educate, and then innovate. So how do you think this new residency program, the surgical residency, will impact our community's health, if you can kind of touch on that?
Yeah, you said it well. Our mission is meant to be all-encompassing, and it really does. Educate is the big word in this one, but it certainly also checks the boxes for healing and leading and other parts of our mission that will be solidified by having mm-hmm. more physicians here. It's really going to bring a lot of interesting ideas, a lot of extended community resources, and hopefully physicians that stay in the area and are able to practice and see the patients of the community.
Right.
So that's our ultimate goal, is to have them practice
right.
here.
Where are the facilities? Like, where will they be trained as part of this education program?
As part of our new tower construction that was done last year, finished last year, we had some GME space that was created in the tower.
Like residents?
Yep. So okay. we have residents need, we are required to support them with a lot of, you know, they have to have sleeping quarters. Mm-hmm. They have to have private areas in order to be able to study. They have to have protected space. They certainly need space to lounge and, you know, yeah. let out some stress and get a snack and, you know, because they'll be in the hospital for many, many hours end on end. And so when we did the new tower construction, we used one of those spaces to create their sleeping quarters, their conference rooms, their rounding spaces, their lounge space. It's about 17,000 square feet that's built out now. Mm-hmm. It looks beautiful. We can't wait for them to move in. They've got locker rooms. They've got really everything that they need to be able to continue taking care of patients for long periods of time. And the next stage, which will be phase two, is when we will add on to that space with a what we call simulation labs.
Yeah, what is that?
Sim labs are a replica of some of the other spaces in the hospital where they can practice. So we will have mannequins in there.
Oh.
They'll be able to. It'll be a space that looks like a real operating room. Mm-hmm. Has all of the functionality of it. Has all the tools and equipment in there, and they'll have mannequins in there, and they can perform, quote unquote, perform surgeries. They can use the equipment that they would have in a real operating uh-huh. room, so they can really try to mimic what a surgery would be like under the guidance of the teachers of their faculty. Mm-hmm. And so with their attending surgeons watching over them and giving them feedback, they can walk through all of the, you know, easy and the hard parts of taking care of yeah. patients as best as possible.
I'm thinking back about that game, Operation. I mean, in AI, Jason and I have talked about AI quite a bit on the show,
yeah.
but
yeah.
this is pretty cool stuff.
It's great.
For residents.
It's really
this
great.
Is awesome.
I mean, when you get into a tough situation with a patient, mm-hmm. you definitely don't want that to be done without having some practice. And so you can simulate all kinds of scenarios. You can simulate somebody having a heart attack on the table, mm-hmm. and how do you run a code in an operating room? You'd prefer to be able to run through those scenarios many times before it actually happening, so that
yeah.
they can really kind of get their understanding of how to run the room and how to be able to take care of the patient and the whole team. So there's hundreds of different scenarios yeah. that they will go through to be able to prepare themselves, so that when they get out into the real world, they have seen it before and they
right.
have some teaching.
I think the patients are going to be really lucky to have this new crop of surgical residents. What is your true goal of this residency program? I know your heart is in educating and sharing mm-hmm. the best for people, but what is it that you think Oxner wants to see from this program?
I know they want to see this program be successful, which we are very sure will be. We will take three residents every year. So these three in general surgery are going to be with us for the next 5 years, but we'll eventually have a class of 15 that keep coming uh-huh. every year. And they want to see us expand to all of the other, potentially all the other specialties mm-hmm. that I mentioned, or others that may come up. We have some others that we're thinking through if we have the volume for it and we have the interest. But as Oshner puts a lot of investments in academic programs all over the state, sometimes it's in expanding medical school classes, which is terrific because then you can take more medical students. But then when they finish school, they need a residency spot to land in.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not doing all of this expansion in lockstep, then you're going to have a bottleneck. And so we definitely don't want to have medical students that are out there that don't have a residency spot to go in. And we have the obligation, frankly, as physicians, we have the obligation to train our next group of us. I mean, when we retire and move on, we need people to take care of us.
Right.
So we have an obligation to keep it going. And this is one way to do it. And it's a great way to do it and a really exciting way to bring to Lafayette.
It just seems like with the evolution of healthcare, with computer and artificial intelligence driven surgeries, you know, it's endless, the opportunities for these young students. I think we're all lucky because when I think about how invasive surgery used to be and now you can be treated, you know, with very little downtime. But this is exciting to have this right here in Lafayette.
They are definitely going to come out of their training with some of the newest techniques that, you know, that we've ever seen here. And we want to be able to keep up with what they have learned. We have, you know, several robots already. We have lots of different ways to do robotic surgery or laparoscopic surgery. They're going to be doing a lot of that. And, you know, speaking of AI, that is certainly layering into Ochsner's plans as well, too. We need to figure out how to responsibly use artificial intelligence in the medical community. We are, you know, working on dipping our toe in the water a little bit on seeing how would that layer into the knowledge that's already present with the physicians and the nurses and all the care teams, and then how does it layer into the data that's already within an electronic medical record to only enhance the situation. I want to be careful to say that it needs to be responsible.
Right.
Because when you're talking about AI and healthcare, you know, it can get all really wild, really crazy, really quickly. And so we want to make sure we do it carefully and think through how does that work in a medical community.
Yeah.
But we're not burying our heads in the sand either, saying that it's not real. You know, it's here and we got to figure out how to use it. But residents coming through, the youngest generation of doctors are going to bring that with them. They're going to bring those ideas, and that's going to be really exciting.
Right. So are there other future plans for graduate medical education? I know you're starting with this class. We've got shortages, not just across the country, but for us, critically, the Gulf Coast has got a lot of shortages. But what are you seeing for the future of this?
Certainly, we want to start with those most needed programs, the ones where the physician, where we have the greatest physician shortages. If that's the place where we can start and jump into first, that's what we're going to do. Then, additionally, we need to talk a lot about the rural communities and how do we create teams of doctors that are going to practice in these rural communities where they can train. If they train in the rural communities, they tend to want to practice there too because they understand it. They understand what they have and what they don't have. And then they also understand the patient population. And we want to create, so we want them to train in some of these rural areas. That's something that's on our list of things to get them out there doing. We certainly have the need. And if we can create the scenario for them where they are part of a team, yet also serving underserved communities, then we've hit the jackpot.
Yeah.
So that's our goal. That's what we're after.
I'm just amazed. I think back a few short years ago, Mike, and his last name is escaping me, he was over IT, and we did this meeting at Oakbourne Country Club. It was back in 2017. And we had, of course, some little IT problems, Jason. We were trying to get, you know, internet access, but they were showing me at the time in this Upper Lafayette group that I was running how a physician could, or a nurse could even get a patient looking at the computer screen and look in their nose and throat and ears. And that was big news back just, what, 7 years ago.
Right.
And you were there. Mm-hmm. What an incredible advancement we've seen, especially with COVID.
Mm-hmm.
I just think the sky's the limit for better health care for all of us, especially accessibility, if you want to touch on that.
Absolutely. And a lot of those ideas that Mike Dozier was bringing to the table.
Mike, I apologize. Yeah.
He definitely was setting us up for, you know, for a future. And some of it's here now. So we have been able to put in place telemedicine across all of our campuses in a variety of ways. For instance, we will do a telestroke offering. So our rural hospitals have a patient that comes in that they suspect is having a stroke. The clock starts ticking.
Yeah.
They got to get that medicine as fast as possible.
Yeah.
And sometimes the idea of a transfer is wasted time in there. So We support them by having a stroke team that's ready to jump on a telemedicine visit and guide that ER physician on how to give the medicine. Is it the right thing? Do we need any additional imaging before we do it? And then transfer the patient so that we haven't lost the time in there. We do the same with teleneurology. We have telecardiology. It's really a way, it's not perfect, but it's a way to be able to spread the specialty resources to the areas that you can't possibly have enough physicians to go to. We always have the option of transferring somebody to a hospital that has those in person if that's what's needed. But many times you would find that there is just enough, they give the right kind of guidance over telemedicine that allows the patient to stay in their community without having to be transferred, which is so great for them because their family can be around and they don't have to travel into Lafayette and, you know, 30 miles away. So that is definitely one. I think, you know, there's a there's another example we're starting with in our urgent care using something called TytoCare, which is similar to what you were speaking of, where you can be in the urgent care office with a nurse who's taking your vitals and taking all your medical history, but then the doctor or APP that you might see is at another location, but they're using digital tools to listen to your breath sounds, to look in your ear, to look in your throat. So you're in one location, but your doctor's in another. It allows a doctor in another area who's not busy to see you, and you don't have to wait as long in the waiting room. So we're getting ready to kick that off in our urgent cares too. It's really just spreading the care amongst different places. So it's great. And this is the future. This is what we're looking for. We want to make sure that we do it well, that it's well set up, and that we don't compromise on quality or safety of our patients. But if we can check those boxes, then we are going to be able to scale it quite a bit and serve more people. That's the name of the game. It
touches my heart. My father had a stroke. He had, you know, horrible diabetes and heart complications. And then the stroke, of course, came after amputations of his legs. And I don't know that he could have been helped more, but I know that three-hour window is critical. So if he was in Baton Rouge, he was in the hospital, but things were different 27 years ago. To think about the people whose lives, they can keep their lives with this kind of advanced care, it just really touches my heart.
Definitely. I think all of us, when we see these patient examples happening, it's so fantastic. I mean, my own aunt had a stroke in front of me, actually. She playing with my kids, and she had a stroke right there. And, you know, I quickly assessed her, figured out what was going on, and got her husband to drive her to the hospital. She was going to an Ochsner facility in Baton Rouge, and I just kept yelling at him, started at 1:30. It started at 1:30. Don't, you know, if you don't remember anything else, that's what you need to remember. And got her there, and they had telestroke. They didn't have a neurologist in-house, but that facility in Baton Rouge had telestroke capabilities. So the neurologist dialed in from Baton Rouge, ordered the right CT scans. She did get the TPA or the clot-busting medication.
Before 4:30.
Before 4:30, and it reversed everything.
Oh, my gosh.
And she's a productive member of our family. So
God was there with both of you.
It was great to see that happen. I can share your thoughts around seeing family members go through this. And we had a great outcome on that one. And that's certainly what we want to bring to others.
Well, Jason Sikora has been taking notes. Jason, thank you.
Oh, no, thank you.
Recording us. And
yeah, of course. Yeah. Dr. Amanda Logue, thank you for being here today. I could do a whole second podcast. Look, I want to talk about logistics and the difficulties and technology IT. And so many things. IT. Well, Chris Rader and I were talking ahead of time just about the amount of people that you guys must see every day. And then you said it, 140,000. So I did the numbers, 380 a day. That's 16 an hour. That's like one every 3 minutes walking into your door.
That's just at UHC campus.
Yeah.
Just one campus.
That's not down the street.
Yeah, that's not even the main campus.
That's crazy. All right, so we're going to do a whole other podcast on logistics because that's insane. You started talking about physician shortage. So why are we at this point? What happened or multitude of things that have happened?
It is a multitude. It can't be pointed to just one thing. There has been a some of it's tied into the way the funding is set up and the infrastructure that is needed in order to be able to train physicians. It's hard, and it doesn't always seem like it's possible whenever you need that amount of funding and how to get the funding that you need to start the program from the ground up. Additionally, they have not expanded class sizes of medical schools in quite some time. Some people are, okay. But that takes additional infrastructure. And so the idea of the class I was in was only 100 students. And so it's a 4-year program, and it takes a lot of infrastructure for 4 years of medical students. You have anatomy labs, you have clinical rotations, you have classrooms time, you have it goes on and on. So the idea of schools having enough money to expand class sizes has been a real barrier for a long time. So that's, people are trying to help that. Ochsner has expanded the class size in Shreveport from 100 to 150, and they plan to go to 200 in the future. So people are working on it. Okay. Additionally, in the last few years, not talk about COVID and mm-hmm. what that has done for physicians and their well-being, and making them question whether they still want to be in medicine. We've had physicians that have said, that was something I never want to go through again. It made me see all of the problems we have in healthcare, and I'm out. And then others have said, I want to go part-time. That happens a lot with physician women physicians. Oh, okay. They want to. They got a family to support too, and mm-hmm. they're trying to balance their life a little bit better. And the amount of imbalance that we went through during COVID pushed some people mm-hmm. over, and they just said, "I'm either out or I'm going down to part time, so I can focus on my own well-being and my own family a little bit better."
That makes sense.
Yeah. So it puts all of those put pressures on the shortage and the need that we have.
Okay. So that leads to my next question. AI, wearables, Google, is this a burden for doctors, being that users have access to all this information, sometimes bad information, or is this actually helpful to some extent?
That is a loaded question.
Oh, man. I knew it would be.
We need a podcast just for that. It is helpful and harmful, mostly harmful at the moment where we're in. Okay. We have a lot of opportunities where doing some digital oversight of patients outside of when they're in the room with the doctor is great. Knowing that they can check their blood pressure and transmit it to you when they're at home and they're in a calm space and they're around their family, and it's a more true reflection of what their blood pressure actually is. Mm-hmm. Or diabetes checks, which have to be done fairly often. And having that information really gives doctors and their care team a better idea of what a patient's overall life is like, rather than just a snapshot of when they're in the office. On the flip side, the wearables and that amount of data that can come in, and people looking up mm-hmm. stuff all the time and messaging their doctors all the time, it just doesn't have the evidence behind it yet to show mm-hmm. where I should hone in on the data.
Okay.
So I can wear my watch all day long, but what does that even mean to me until more research is done, you know, to be able mm-hmm. to say, when you look at this, digital data that comes from a patient's wearables or their technology that they use, show me what is the most important framework out of all of this data that comes in. It'll get there, but it's just going to take some time. So in the meantime, it's really quite burdensome on doctors who are getting all this stuff in all the time and trying to figure out what is real and what is mm-hmm. totally not important.
I didn't even think about that, but yet too much data just kind of clutters the picture sometimes.
Right.
Interesting.
And then other AI things like just Googling symptoms. I'm sure people... and there's ads on mm-hmm. TV for medicine. Mm-hmm. Take it, but know that it could kill you. You're like, well, am I better off?
That's right.
Going to see Amanda Logue,
right.
Let her tell me what I need to do.
Yeah, I mean, the Google, Dr. Google, mm-hmm. we call it, or WebMD, which you choose which one. Yeah. They definitely have created a new conversation between patients and physicians. Sometimes they're, onto something. And so, get you thinking. But a lot of times... the doctor would have gotten there with the same information. Mm-hmm. And so it can kind of crowd the field sometimes and make it a little hard to search through. And then you get people who are not quite sure who to trust,
disinformation is a whole thing as
exactly.
well. Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. And then I consider this my fun question, but what is a day in the life of Dr. Amanda, and what do you do for fun?
Oh, gosh. A day in the life... And in my role, I'm involved with our CEO on all kinds of initiatives. So I do spend a lot of time working on, what's our next strategies and building out programs and being part of teams that are creating new, clinical leadership or new facilities or where to build our next, primary care office. And I deal a lot with physicians that are in all of the hospitals, helping them, grease the wheels for things they want to get done or talking to them about clinical scenarios, things that are hard for them to get their work done. How do I help make that easier and better for their patients? And everything in between. Okay. I spend a lot of time with Ochsner as a system. I have a great team of us that represent different regions. And so I really get to learn from, the CMO in Baton Rouge and the one in Shreveport and the one in New Orleans. How are you doing this there? And share best practices. That's the best part of being a system where you can really lean on each other for things like that. For fun, I'm really, at this point in my life with my kids, 16, 14, and 10, I'm trying to spend as much time with them.
It goes so fast.
I have a junior who's I see what's coming next summer. Yep. And so I'm trying to soak up all of the memories with him, trying to go to everything that he doesn't really even want me at. and the younger ones below him, are going to be there quite quickly too. So we spend a lot of time as a family together trying to do all of their activities. And certainly we love to travel when we can. So, other than that, I can't say it's really... I have a really bunch of exciting things. Yes. I mean, I love to cook. I get in the garden,
That's wonderful.
Play at the house, stuff like that.
It looks like you exercise. I mean,
I do. I try to keep, that's sanity, that helps keep you sane, keeps me sane.
Exactly.
So I just definitely try to stay fit. It comes and goes.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you again for coming down here. This is fantastic. And I'd love to have you back at some point to tech all my other questions. And Jen, thank you again.
I appreciate it. It's my pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you so much, both of you. I really enjoyed this. It's been just a great conversation. Of course, I love showcasing what we're doing at Lafayette General, but I just love the conversation as well, too.
Yeah.
But thanks for having me.
Thank you both. And, Ochsner has been very generous to us supporting our podcast, and I'm just grateful for that. And also your expertise. Thank you for what you do again.
Oh, absolutely.
Dr. Amanda Logue.
Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for listening. So grateful for your continued support. If you haven't yet, please subscribe to wherever you get your podcast. You can just click Discover Lafayette and it'll be delivered every Friday.
Yeah.
At some point during the day, we release a new podcast. And also, we couldn't do this without our sponsors. I want to thank Raider, Ochsner, Lafayette General, and ViMed. Thank you so much for your ongoing support. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, we're grateful for you. This is Jan Swift. Thank you.